It's a great pleasure to talk about some work that I've done in collaboration with these people at Oxford. And I'm going to be talking about supersymmetric case theories on squash S5 spheres and dark gravity duals. So I will start off with a bit of motivation. So as we all know, localization is a very powerful tool to compute exact quantities in supersymmetric gauge theories on curved backgrounds. Now, from the viewpoint of ADS-CFT, it is then rather natural to ask whether or not we can find a gravity dual to these observables. Now, this is very well studied in three dimensions. So there's been a vast majority of, there's been a huge, huge influx of different backgrounds that have been studied and on which one can put supersymmetry on. For example, last year there was a paper on very generic topology, like very generic backgrounds with the topology of a 3-sphere. And at the beginning of this year, the gravity duals to such metrics were constructed. One can also look at backgrounds that don't have trivial fundamental group, such as lens spaces, and one can also compute the supergravity duals. This is just two examples out of a huge amount of examples that have been considered. And usually, one looks then at tests to check the ADS-CFT correspondence. Such tests usually include the large n limit of the free energy on gauge theories. And also, one can look at Wilson loops, which in three dimensions are dual to some in two brain. And one can also consider vortex loops, for example. So as I've said, the story is very well studied in three dimensions. And I guess as it goes in our field, the idea is to extend that to higher dimensions. And today, we'll be looking at five-dimensional gauge theories and their gravity duals. So the situation is a bit in a bit more elementary phase in five dimensions. On the gauge theory side, there's been various examples on of backgrounds one can put supersymmetry on. For example, and I hope I don't forget anyone here. If I do, I'm sorry. for example, one can put it on round or squashed 5-spheres, or the Sasaki-Einstein manifolds, YPQ spaces, and then one can use localization to compute the partition function for these spaces. For our purpose, it will be important that the perturbative part of the partition function has been computed for the squashed 5-sphere. So how about gravity duals? Well, here the situation is even more dire. Well, one can ask why is this so? And there are several reasons for that, I guess. Well, first of all, we would be working in six-dimensional supergravity, which has a lot of fields and computations are quite hard to do. Furthermore, there. so as I've written down here, the gravity background is a warped product of ADS6 times S4, for example, in the case of the round sphere. And it turns out that it has a point in the supergravity where the supergravity approximation breaks down. So this discouraged several people to look at it. And furthermore, if one wants to compute the holographic free energy, you have to include a lot of counter terms. And as I said, the 6D theories are quite complicated and have quite a big field content. So these counter terms are quite extensive, and it's a very long computation. Now, in the case of Wilson loops, there's only one counter term one has to consider. And so this was studied by these people here. And it was shown that for fundamental Wilson loop or for Wilson loops in the fundamental representation, the dual are fundamental strings, and for generic representations other than the fundamental, there are some D4 brains in the bulk. And this first group here, they looked at the entanglement entropy of the supergravity background in order to avoid these issues that I was just been talking about. So anyways, even though it's kind of hard and very computational, we thought, well, let's try and do it. And we looked at computing the supergravity duals for squashed phi spheres. So here's here's the outline of my talk. In the first two sections, I will be talking about 5D supersymmetry, and especially we'll consider the case of squashed phi sphere, and then show how to compute the large N limit. In the second part of the talk, I will focus on the supergravity. So we construct the supergravity, the six-dimensional supergravity, which is in our case Roman's F4 gauge supergravity, and I'll show you how we construct our solutions. And then I will show you, well, I will look at two checks that we've performed. On the one side, we looked at the holographic free energy and compared it to the large N limit of the free energy on the gauge theory side. And on the other hand, depending on time, I will talk about Wilson loops and their large N limit and how they map to fundamental strings in the bulk. Okay. Let's start with supersymmetric gauge theories in five dimensions. Let's start with mentioning something very general first. So as you might know, supersymmetric gauge theories in five dimensions are non-renormalizable. So one might then ask, well, how can we compute a partition function in such a theory in an exact way? Well, the idea, and this has to be made precise, this is just sort of the arguments that people use nowadays. The idea is that if we have a UV superconformal fixed point, and we look at a quantity that is independent of the RG flow, we should be just simply able to look at the IR description and find and compute the path integral there. The other argument that people use is that in the UV, all these non-renormalizable terms, if they are Q exact, they will not contribute to the localized path integral, and so we can neglect them. As I've said, though, this has to be made precise. So the example that we'll be looking at is a five-dimensional L equals one superconformal fixed point with an enhanced global symmetry, which comes from instanton charges. And we look at this, and as I said, we just ignore the UV part and compute the path integral in the IR. And this corresponds by adding this mass deformation of the Young-Mills term. This corresponds to a five-dimensional USB2 N gauge theory with some finely tuned matter. Okay. So we can look at the squashed five sphere. We look at a squashed five sphere with SU3 times U1 isometry, which can be written as a vibration over CP2, like this. We have an SU3 isometry on CP2, and here's the U1 fiber. And S is the squashing parameter, so for S equals 1, we return to the round sphere, and for S non equals 1, we have the squashed case. And C is related to the caliform on CP2. Now, the squashing breaks the isometry to SU3 times U1, and so the supercharges that are transforming in the fundamental and antifundamental of SU4 will break down to two different cases. There's the one case, which we shall denote by 3/4 BPS, where the supercharges transform in a fundamental and in a 3 and 3 bar of SU3, and the other case is when they transform in a singlet of SU3. And it turns out they preserve 3/4 and 1/4 of the supersymmetry. Now, as the usual story goes, we have to turn on a background R-symmetry gauge field, like this. And where Q is equals to 1 for the 3/4 BPS and -3 for the 1/4 BPS, respectively. Notice that this, for the round sphere case, one doesn't need to include this, or this is not included. Like, one doesn't have to turn on this background gauge field. Furthermore, one can then find Killing spinner equation and DiLatino equations and find explicit solutions for that in these two cases. So in the 3/4 BPS and the 1/4 BPS. Okay. Now that we've set up the geometry, let's think about how we can compute the path integral. This has been done by Imamura in an indirect way. So he starts by looking at the six-dimensional theory on R times S5. of a metric of this form, where t is the parameterizes the r direction, and the wi is parametrized to the phi sphere. Now one can then go on and compactify this six-dimensional theory with a by including a certain twist. So we compactify the t direction, and we include this twist here, depending on these mu I parameters, these twist parameters. And by rewriting the metric in different coordinates and by identifying these mu parameters with the squashing, one then ends up in the squashed phi sphere metric by taking beta to zero. So again, this is sort of the geometric motivation to do that and to compute the path integral and to compute the partition function. One can then start with computing the six-dimensional n equals 1, 0 index, and then take the beta going to 0 limit. And that should yield the perturbative part of the partition function. Again, this was done by Imamura. So applying this procedure, we'll end up with the perturbative part of the partition function, which is given in this form for a generic matter. And so this is the classical contribution as usual. And these are the one loop determinants for the vector multiplet and the matter here. A rho is a weight in R, and alpha is a root of the gauge group. Okay. I should mention, so B is related to the squashing parameters, or rather from the 6D perspective, it's related to these mu I twistings that we introduced in the slide before. And we see here that for the 3/4 BPS, the Bs are of this form, and for the 1/4 BPS, they're all the same, given of this form. And it's interesting to notice that in the quarter BPS case, one can actually remove the dependence on the squashing parameter S in the partition function and rewrite it as in the case of the round sphere. And in case you know this story in three dimensions, this is exactly similar to there, where you have one squashing that is basically trivial, or the partition function isn't sensitive to it, whereas the other squashing, which is our 3/4 BPS, is. And yeah, I mean, if you don't know, this is the triple sine function, which is defined in terms of the Barnes multiple gamma function. Okay, so now we've set up, we have the perturbative part of the partition function. And since we want to compare it to supergravity, we should look at the large n limit of this. Well, before we do that, actually, we have to specify what theory might have a supergravity dual. And it turns out, a long time ago, this was found that there's a class of five-dimensional superconformal field theories which arise in a D4, D8 brain system. In the presence of some Orient fold, and they should have a large N description in terms of massive type 2A supergravity. And this was checked, or this was computed in these three papers. Namely, they computed the near horizon geometry near these D4 world volume brains, and it turns out to be a Warp product. Well, in the round sphere case, it turns out to be a Warp product of ADS6 times an S4 hemisphere. And for us, since we're looking at a squash sphere, we have a deformation, which I will call M6, of a deformation of ADS6. So, but since we're now still on the gauge theory side, the important thing is we should look at gauge theories living on D4 brains and their mirrors, which is given by an USP2N gauge group with NF less than equal to 7 matter fields in a fundamental plus a single hypermultiplet in the antisymmetric representation. Okay, so we set up the stage, and now we can compute the large N limit. Well, not exactly, or not yet, not just yet. First of all, we set the classical transimens level to 0. This is because it won't contribute in the Lagrangian, because the third Casimir of the gauge group is 0. And the second question we have to ask, which is quite important, in five dimensions, we have instanton contributions. And so the full partition function should look something like this. And as I've written it down here, it looks like, well, our UV fixed point sits at where we take the bare coupling to infinity. So it looks like these instanton contributions should actually contribute. which would be bad because we don't actually have them. But it turns out that it is conjectured that they actually don't contribute, and well, our check basically confirms that. And the argument is that actually the instantons go with the effective coupling, which is then of order n to the 1/2, where this n is the same as up here. And so it will be like these contributions in the sum here will be exponentially suppressed. However, again, an explicit calculation of this is outstanding. Okay, so putting these issues aside and computing the large n limit, which requires an asymptotic expansion of the triple sine functions, or rather the logarithm of the triple sine functions, gives the following result. And again, we see that in the quarter BPS case, the B's cancel out, so it doesn't depend on the squashing. It's just the round sphere case. It's just the same as the round sphere. And in the three-quarter BPS, we have this prefactor here that depends on the B's. And again, it's interesting to note that this is very, very similar to the three-dimensional case. So I don't know, some of you might know that in the three-dimensional case, we have two squashing parameters, B1 and B2. And in the large n limit, it would be B1 plus B2 squared over 8 times B1 times B2. So there seems to be a very general story here at work. And I guess the next step would be to compute the squashed 7 sphere, I guess. So if anyone has nothing to do. Okay, so now we have the large n limit for our theories, and we want to construct the supergravity solutions and the supergravity action, which should give the same result by the ADS CFT prediction. First of all, we have to specify what supergravity we're looking at. So as I've said before, this gauge theory is conjectured to be dual to a supergravity background of this form in massive type 2A supergravity in 10 dimensions. Now, we don't really want to work in 10 dimensions, and it turns out that there is a nice result that Roman's F4 gauge supergravity, that all of Roman's F4 gauge supergravity actually uplift to this 10-dimensional background, which was shown by Svetich, Lu, and Poe. Of course, they only showed the case of ADS6, but this, since we're looking at an extension of that, we had to check that, but it's basically trivial. So on the supergravity side, we can focus on six-dimensional supergravity, which is given by an Euclidean version of Roman's F4 gauge supergravity. okay. So the bosonic field content of this supergravity is given by a metric, dilaton phi, which we'll denote by x in the future. There's a one-form potential A with this field strength. There's a two-form potential B, and there's an R-symmetry gauge field AI. Furthermore, it turns out that if we rescale our fields in an appropriate way, the gauge coupling will just be an overall constant in front of the action integral, and so we can set it without loss of generality to 1. Furthermore, it turns out that A is a Stückelberg field, which means that we can set it to 1, and then gives a mass to the B field, to the two-form B field, which you can see here. Furthermore, this B field has a Jordan-Simons coupling here. So it turns out that this is actually quite on net or. Well, this makes computations much harder, especially when we compute the counter terms. This B field turns up all over the place. okay. And so we had to Wick rotate that. So this action was only known in the Lorentzian in Minkowski signature, and so we had to Wick rotate it, which turns out to just introduce an I here, vector of I. So now from this section, we can derive equations of motion for the supergravity. And in order for our supergravity to be supersymmetric, we have to, well, this the dilatina as well as a Killing spinner equation should hold. Yeah, you don't have to remember that. It's quite a mess. okay, so then let's think about how we can construct our solutions. So the idea is to get a smart ansatz, and based on that, compute compute the solution analytically, ideally. So what do we want from our onsets? We have a squashed sphere with an SU3 times U1 symmetry. And so we expect that in the bulk that this is preserved, which leads to a metric that can only be of this form, where we have where we've introduced three functions, beta of R, gamma of R, and alpha of R. then for the one form AI and for the scalar X, we don't have an SU3 invariant one form on CP2, and so there's no contribution that depends on CP2. And we, of course, have this one form that is U1 invariant. And that could be a term, in principle, that could be a term of the form F of R dr. But it turns out that that's pure gauge. So we can just neglect it and have this onsets here. And similarly for the function here. And for the B field, we have actually two SU3 times U1 invariant two forms, namely the Keller form on CP2. And this form here, dr, which d tau plus c. You remember dc is the Keller form on CP2. Okay. Now we want to construct smooth, supersymmetric, asymptotically locally ADS solutions with the topology of a ball. So the idea is that we have a conformal boundary of a squashed sphere, and we fill it with a bulk solution, basically. So at the conformal boundary, we want to have this squashed SI sphere. And our fields have to match onto the fields in the Moore's case. So we've introduced this coordinate R. And of course, we can always reparametrize that. And we use this freedom to explicitly fix beta to the ADS value. Furthermore, we can do an SO3 rotation so that we only have to consider one of the three fields here, and we take the two others to be zero. We call the F3. Okay, so now we have a nice ansatz for our solutions, and the next step is to take this ansatz and plug it into the equations of motion and find a general solution that is not necessarily supersymmetric. So one can do that, and you get seven coupled differential equations for six unknown functions. And we tried very long and hard to solve them analytically, but at some point, it seems like it's very hard. And so we decided to look at expansions around certain backgrounds that we know. So two kinds of expansions come up at, well, are very natural to choose. First of all, we expand around the round ADS6 case with a parameter delta, where delta is related to the squashing parameter S that I've introduced before. So for all of our fields, we make the ansatz like this. And this corresponds to a region, basically, where the squashing parameter is small. And this is a nice choice for these two kinds of solutions that we want to get, where S, well, the relation between S and this small parameter delta. The second expansion that we're considering is an expansion around the conformal boundary at R infinity. So as I've told you before, we have the squashed sphere at the boundary, and it sits at R infinity. And we want to expand about this conformal boundary. So for example, well, we introduce the appropriate expansions for our fields. And of course, these are determined by matching on to the boundary, to the conformal boundary, which is the theory that Imamura described in five dimensions. Okay. So we find very general solutions of the equations of motion for these expansions.
Sorry, what's the difference between alpha? They all have the same polar. Did you lose law or something? The last line.
The difference between that's a typo. I'm sorry. So yeah, thanks a lot. That should be 1/r^3. And these alphas all then explicitly depend on the squashing parameter S.
Okay.
I'll show you a solution in a second. So as I was saying, we look at these expansions and construct solutions order by order for the general equations of motion. But we want our theory to be supersymmetric. And in principle, one would have to solve for epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, or find solution for epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, which are the killing spinners in the bulk, and the Dilatino equations. However, we don't want to consider further differential constraints, and so we look at what we call an integrability condition, which is basically a way to rewrite the killing spinner equation in terms of pure fields, and so basically decouple or reduce the problem of finding epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 to an algebraic problem of that is decoupled from epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. Okay, so we can rewrite this part here in terms of the killing spinner equation, which gives a huge mess. And after long and careful analysis, it turns out that we can rewrite the conditions in this form, where A and B are now A times A matrices. So in order for this to have a solution, we have to have a non-trivial kernel, and so we require that the determinant of these two parts should be zero. And then it turns out, again, this is a huge mess, but it turns out that the determinant factorizes into this nice form here, where these fi's are four gigantic functions. And this gives us a way to classify the supersymmetries that we have in our bulk. So it turns out that if we set, for example, we can start by setting F1 to 0 here. And it turns out then that this requires that F2 and F3 are also 0, and F4 is non-zero. And it turns out this gives us this three-quarter BPS case that we've discussed before. Equally, one can set F4 to 0, where then F1 and F2 and F3 are non-zero. And this gives rise to the one-quarter BPS solution. Okay. So now we have, I should mention, so by solving the equations of motion without supersymmetry constraint, we have a lot of constants of integration. By fixing or by looking at this integrability condition, all of these constants can be determined explicitly. And so we have a solution that is very, very rigid, that has a very rigid structure. And it turns out we can first look at a three-quarter BPS solution. It turns out that as expected, we get a one-parameter family of solutions for the metric and the field. So for example, I've written down here one solutions. We've done this to very high order. As you see, there's no constants involved here anymore except this S, which is exactly the squashing parameter, or this one that parameterizes this solution. We have this kappa here, but this can be determined by requiring that the solution holds in the whole of the bulk. We compare these solutions with the solutions as an expansion in delta, and we can rewrite kappa in terms of an expansion of delta. So this is actually also fixed. Okay, great. So now we have a solution. We still used a slightly less strong condition on the for supersymmetry. So what we have to do next to confirm that we actually have three-quarter BPS supersymmetry, we have to compute the killing spinners. So we can do that, and it turns out that it shows that three-quarters of the supersymmetries are preserved, and so we're actually dealing with the three-quarter BPS solution. Now, since we have now the killing spinners, it's interesting to look at the killing vectors, which are given by this in six dimension, where C is the charge conjugation matrix. And we can consider, we impose symplectic Majorana condition, and then we can compute the killing bilinears. Now, since we start with a theory that has SU3 times U1 symmetry, but actually we want to actually have a prediction for a more general U1 times U1 times U1 isometric solution. So in that sense, we require this K to be sitting within this U1 times U1 times U1 Lie algebra of this form, where the phi i's are just the Angular variables in the embedding of S5 into R6. And it turns out that this fixes all of our integration constants that we still had in the killing spinner. And it turns out that BIs are given exactly in this way, which is exactly the same as at the conformal boundary. Again, this is very analogous to the 3D case, where one can write the general solutions of the bulk in terms of a killing vector that is parameterized by B1 and B2. However, in the 3D case, they've checked this for this very general U1 times U1 times U1 isometry, whereas in our case, we basically only did this. But it lets us conjecture that the general form should be very equivalent to the 3D case. Okay, so we looked at the three-quarter BPS solution. And let me briefly mention how the story goes in the quarter BPS case. So again, we looked at the expansions around the conformal boundary and around the round ADS. And in this case, we found a two-parameter family of solutions. So this family of solutions is parameterized by a squashing S, which is, again, the same as the squashing in the 5D theory. But there is also another parameter, which we call F naught. And this F naught is actually related to the gauge field, to the background gauge field A at the boundary that I've showed you before. And in order to match on to Imamura's solution in 5D, we have to tune the parameter F naught in a correct way. Again, we can consider the killing vector. And in this case, it turns out to be just given by d tau. And we can rewrite this again as b1, d phi 1, b2, d phi 2, b3, d phi 3. So again, in this maximal torus of, and the Lie algebra of the maximal torus of this u1 times u1 times u1 isometry subgroup. And again, we see that the BIs are actually given by are all equal to 1. And so again, as expected, this reduces to the same as the round sphere case. Furthermore, having this new parameter F naught gives or lets us conjecture something about the results in 5 dimensions. So we expect that there are more results than the ones found so far in 5 dimensions. For example, one can consider tuning this F naught to be 0. So basically turning off this background gauge field, but still have a squashing. And that should give rise to a one-quarter BPS solution in the bulk, or rather one-quarter BPS on the squashed 5 sphere. Alternatively, one should be able to have very generic A here, but still have a round sphere. So these are two interesting cases one could look at in 5 dimensions that have not been considered yet. Okay. So great. Now we have solutions to this one-quarter BPS and three-quarter BPS case. And now we want to check. Now we want to check ADS CFT. And by doing so, in the first instance, we want to check the free energy, the holographic free energy in the supergravity on the supergravity side against the large n limit that we've computed before of the partition function.
So the solutions that you constructed, they are again perturbed using the squashing parameter, right? So this construction on the gravity side, it's perturbative in delta, which is related to small.
Yes. So well, we have these two expansions. One is around ADS, round ADS. So then the expansion is in the squashing parameter, basically. And we have another expansion, which is around the conformal boundary.
That one I don't understand quite. So can you guarantee that the other one is smooth everywhere as you extend it from the conformal boundary into the bulk?
Yeah,
of course, we can construct lots of solutions near the conformal boundary, but most of them are actually singular in the bulk.
Yeah, exactly. So we checked both of the solutions. That's why we have both of the solutions. We checked them against each other, which fixes exactly this.
Right.
This,
so but again,
this
that's,
kappa
that,
here.
But that simply means that you can trust, you know, the you know basically what kappa is. only to really mode in delta, or you need this other, you need this matching in delta in order to
guarantee.
So that's why I'm saying that, so the gravitational part of the discussion is perturbative in delta.
Yeah, you're right. The structure is extremely rigid, so there's not really, like in these solutions, there's not really a lot we can actually tune. So literally this kappa was the only thing that we couldn't fix by just looking at one expansion.
Right, but the point is that if you don't fix it at the right value, this is like really normalizable modes.
Yeah.
The fields.
No, no, of
course. Then you get a singularity.
Yeah,
of
course.
In the
okay, so with these solutions, we can now go about computing the renormalized holographic free energy. So as I've said in the beginning, we have that this bulk term is has divergences, and so we have to add counter terms. First of all, and also we have to add a given Taucom term because we have a boundary on a manifold. Now computing these counter terms is quite a mess, and it took us a long time to do so. But basically, it's a very straightforward computation of the holographic renormalization. And again, this B field that is massive and has cubic Chern-Simons interaction is what makes this computation quite hard. So you see, well, it appears almost everywhere here. Anyways, this is I just want to put it here to show that it's quite a long thing. Plus, we have quite a lot of terms in the bulk too, and we have this given Hawking term. So you can imagine this section is, or this integral that we have to compute is extremely long. But it should reduce to the large n limit of these of the gauge theory prediction. And well, you can put this into Mathematica, and then put in our solution, and it turns out that it reduces to a very simple these very simple formulas here. So let's consider the three-quarter BPS case. We find, if we plug in our solutions, we find an expansion of this form. And this precisely agrees with the large n limit of the free energy if we expand it in delta, which is extremely surprising. Again, I mean, our solutions are extremely messy. Our integrand is extremely messy. But in the end, we just get a very simple answer. And I think this hints on the fact that there's more structure to it, and we're trying to analyze that at the moment. And similarly, for the quarter BPS case, again, these solutions are pretty messy, and it turns out it just reduced to the round sphere case. So we don't have any dependence on the squashing parameter here. Okay, so great. So we matched the free energy on both sides of the correspondence, and we want to do another check, which is Wilson loops.
So before you go there, so what about, so this delta cube term, so you know, you have control over delta cube term as well on the gravity side?
Yeah. I mean, we've computed this up to, I think, delta 6 or delta 7. I mean, this is just also the solutions. I mean, I didn't show all of them. That would be way too long. So the next check that we'll perform is look at Wilson loops and their gravity duals. So initially, well, first of all, we have to compute the large n limit of Wilson loops. So this is the definition of a Wilson loop, where R is some general representation. We only focused on the fundamental representation, but any other representations are a bit harder to do, but in principle, one should be able to do that too. Here, this is the gauge field. And this is the scalar in the vector multiply. Now, to have some supersymmetry preserved, we have to take the Wilson loop along the Killing bilinear, which is given by this. So this is the five-dimensional charge conjugation now. So again, sorry, just to make sure, we're now on the conformal boundary. Okay, so we've computed the large n limit and of the partition function. And that gave us certain saddle point configurations. Now, the Wilson loop will not change the saddle point configuration, And so basically, we can just take them over and compute this integral, which is very easy to do. Where now, this is the length of our curve. And rho is rho and lambda are the eigenvalue distribution and the density of the eigenvalues if we take the large n then. So again, since we're taking it along the orbits of this Killing bilinear, we get three invariant cycles that we can consider the Wilson loop on. And so we get three different solutions for the fundamental case. Okay, so what does this correspond on the supergravity side? As I said in the introduction, this was computed for the round sphere by this group of people. And it's exactly the same case for us, actually. So instead of ADS6, we have now a more general manifold with our metric that is an expansion in terms of delta. And the fundamental string for which we have to compute the action sits at the point of this hemisphere here and traces out the orbit on the squashed phi sphere and also the radial direction. So it's topologically, it's a disk. now we can compute the regularized action of this fundamental string on this submanifold. To do so, we have to lift our solution, or we have to lift our solution back to 10 dimensions and compute the fundamental string action there. It can be shown that this is given by this plus this counter term, which is the length of the boundary of sigma. Here, gamma is the induced metric on sigma, and B is the uplift of our B field to 10 dimensions, which is just the Wessumino term. Okay. So again, this is much simpler actually than the regularized action that we've considered before, and that's exactly the reason why these guys looked at this case. And yeah, I mean, you only have one counter term here. Anyways, we can put in, again, we can take our solution, uplift it to 10 dimensions, and put it into this formula and compute the Wilson loop. And we again get an expansion in this form. And similarly, well, this is for the first circle in the squashed sphere. But similarly for S2 and S3, we get some expansion. And again, we can compare it to the large n limit. And it turns out if we compare the expansion, they're exactly the same. And similarly, in the quarter BPS case, again, we expect it to be independent of the squashing parameter, and this is exactly what we found. Well, apparently I'm much quicker than I expected, so we're almost done. We can now make a few conjectures. So based on our results and very similar statements in three and four dimensions, we can make these two conjectures. First of all, for any supersymmetric supergravity solution with the topology of a six sphere, of a six ball, sorry, with at least these U1 times U1 isometry, which is more general than what we considered, and with a killing vector of this form, we expect that the holographic free energy is simply given by this. And again, it's very surprising that like this huge action should reduce to something very very simple here. And I mean, having a more general U1 times U1 times U1 isometry than what we've considered should actually give rise to more complicated or more general solutions on the bulk. But even so, it should reduce to this very, very simple formula here. And on the 5D, on the gauge theory side, we can conjecture that any conformal boundary, any supersymmetric gauge theory on the conformal boundary of a background of this form should be given by, or should have a finite n partition function that only depends on this Killing vector, or rather on these parameters v1, v2, and v3. Again, these conjectures have been proven in three and four dimensions. And it's very natural to extend them to five and six dimensions on the basis of our result. Okay. Well, let's briefly summarize what we've done. So we performed, first and foremost, we performed the very non-trivial check of the ADS-CFT correspondence by comparing the free energy and the Wilson loops to the bulk equivalents. Furthermore, we constructed all the necessary ingredients in the supergravity side. So we've constructed the Euclidean action. We've constructed all of these integrability conditions, and this is now one can now start and study this in more detail and maybe find some try and find some analytic solutions. Furthermore, something that I didn't show because I didn't think I'd have time is that we reduced the Killing spinner equation and Dilatino equations on the bulk to the Killing spinners and Killing spinner equation and Dilatino equation on the boundary in very general terms, so independent of our solutions. For our solution, though, we can match them to the 5D's case, so the Imamura case. However, this case having these very general Killing spinner equations and Dilatino equations on the boundary gives actually a way to try and study very general very general backgrounds on the five dimensions that should give rise to a supergravity dual. One problem with that is that our Killing spinner that we've obtained on the boundary is actually not a straightforward Killing spinner equation, but it's rather what one calls a generalized charge conformal Killing spinner equation. And so one step will be to rewrite this in terms of Killing spinner equation that is purely in terms of the fields, and then maybe one can study the backgrounds that the backgrounds in five dimensions that allow a supergravity dual. furthermore, on the supergravity side, as I've said before, we've analyzed or we set up the whole supergravity side in rather much in quite a lot of detail. So one can go about looking at this in a more deeper way, in the sense that one can see whether or not the local structures of the supersymmetry or what kind of constraints the local structure of the supersymmetry imposes on the manifold or on the background manifold. And possibly based on that, one can look at more general solutions or more general class of solutions, as well as maybe it should be, or we expect that it's possible that that with more structure on the in the supergravity, one can actually compute the action as just well analytically basically. So as just terms that are that live on the boundary. And lastly, well, in general, it would be interesting to look at more general metrics in five dimensions. Again, very similar to the case in three dimensions, where one can look at sphere-like topology, for example, in five dimensions, and see whether or not these are dual to some supergravity that we looked at. For this, one would have to start looking at a rigid limit in five dimensions that would actually give rise to what rather general class of conform of backgrounds. That's it.
What's raw facts? You mentioned the eigenvalue density distribution, but you didn't give it specific peak. Can you say, or it's too complicated?
So I mean, well, when you take when we take the large n limit in right. in the field theory, we get the saddle point contribution, and rho of x is just the density of.
I understand. What's the value? What's the
That's a great question. I can't remember. I mean, it's a linear function. In terms of that,
but it's not something simple.
I think it's rather simple. It's a linear function in X, but I don't know the prefactor anymore. I can't remember. But it's in our paper.
It's a linear function, so it's not bounded.
Lambda is a linear function in X or in the square root of X, and rho is a constant actually. So the eigenvalue distribution is constant.
It's a constant.
Yes. Yeah. I'm sorry.
I have a question. Can you turn on the background gauge field for the flavor charges and do the Magellan analysis?
A background gauge?
The for flavors.
Well, possibly you could. I don't know. We didn't look at that.
Let's thank you.